This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. This is the fourth week of July, and this week it was Mueller time. Robert Mueller testified before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, and, well, I'm not sure we learned very much. That was clearly Mueller's intent. He already wrote the report that people could read if they felt like it. He said in May the report was his testimony, and he wouldn't go beyond it. So Democrats spent much of the hearing quoting from the report and asking Mueller to affirm that what he had said in the report was true. They also tried and failed to get him to say the president had committed acts that would get most people indicted for obstruction of justice, were they not sitting presidents who are protected by a longstanding Department of Justice memo that says you can't indict a sitting president. Republicans, for their part, wanted him to talk about the Steele dossier and the origins of the FBI investigation into people around the Trump campaign, which Mueller wouldn't do, saying that's not his purview. We will talk about those hearings in a moment. Later in the show, we'll be joined by two academics focused on climate policy. One of them has a provocative thesis that the Green New Deal is far less expensive than it appears. Also, Evelyn Farkas will join us to talk about rising tensions with Iran and the president's unusual efforts to get American rapper ASAP Rocky sprung from Swedish jail. But now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Rich, what did you make of the Mueller hearings?
Well, it was obviously a fizzle, and we all learned afterwards that it had been an open secret in Washington that Bob Mueller had lost a step. Unfortunately, we saw that demonstrated on live TV for 4 or 5 hours, and top Democrats must have known this, but just been so desperate to try to create a TV moment that would catalyze and shake something loose on the impeachment dynamic, they went through it anyway. So it wasn't a game changer. Instead, it was a little bit sad. And I think the main thing we learned is that it was very unlikely that Bob Mueller was rigorously in charge of his own investigation.
So, Felicia, I think to Rich's point, a lot of the disappointment was that Mueller did not serve anybody's political goals. Certainly, he didn't do what Democrats were hoping in terms of the TV moments out of this hearing. I also don't think he provided a great deal for Republicans. I think, you know, to Rich's point, there's this talk about him having lost a step. I didn't think he was as bad as a lot of people thought he was. I mean, he's clearly hard of hearing, and he's clearly, you know, he's 75. He's less energetic than he once was. I thought he got better in terms of his performance through the day. But I do think that it was partly that, you know, that Bob Mueller is less energetic than he once was, but it was also partly he was trying not to be interesting. And so that he was not interesting is not necessarily a failure on his part.
No, that's right. We could have expected that. He told us that. You know, I think the most sad and also actually alarming part of the entire set of testimonies, the really wanton disrespect that many elected Republicans showed to Mueller himself. You had Sensenbrenner accusing him of phishing. You had Gohmert, you know, trying to enter into the record a piece called Robert Mueller Unmasked. And this just seems like an attempt to actually personally attack him. You know, there are real underlying issues here about what the president attempted to do to obstruct justice. I think these remain very serious issues, and all of that is obstructed by these questions about Mueller himself. I find that really actually quite scary.
Rich, to Felicia's point, one thing that Mueller did seem interested in talking about at length was past and ongoing Russian threats to U.S. elections, which is something that is discussed somewhat in part one of his report. There are also counterintelligence findings that have not been and probably never will be made public that relate to that. He clearly wanted more focus on those efforts for 2020. Republican Congressman Will Hurd spent his time on that in the House Intelligence Committee hearing, but otherwise it wasn't a big issue. Shouldn't this be something that is a focus for members in both parties, something that really one can learn a lot from, both what's in the report we've seen and then what's in some material that we're not privy to, but that is in the government's possession?
Yes, but I don't know why we need Bob Mueller to tell us that. I think there's been this ridiculous puffing up of Bob Mueller, some sort of oracle, where if you write something down in the report, you know, that's one thing. But if he actually says it in a yes or no answer in congressional testimony, then, you know, it's unassailably true, and now everyone has to rally around this. He's just a guy. He's just a prosecutor, and members of Congress can make their own judgments about all these matters. And I didn't see any personal attacks on him from Republicans. I did see some Republicans very effectively raising the issue that this new prosecutorial standard of not exonerated exists nowhere in our law, nowhere in precedent. It's impossible, I think, to think of any U.S. attorney who's ever advanced such a standard. And this was put to Mueller, sometimes without giving an opportunity to respond, but sometimes actually in a back and forth, and he could do nothing to defend it because it's indefensible.
But on the Russian interference operations issue, this isn't something that Mueller was confining himself to yes or no answers on, and it's not something where he's just some guy. He's the former director of the FBI with extensive experience in counterintelligence. Obviously, there are other people who are also experts on this issue, but this is an issue where his relevant standing is not just that he's a former prosecutor, it's his experience as a counterintelligence
people
official.
People were making a huge deal, like a major moment at the hearing was when Adam Schiff said, you know, is it unpatriotic and wrong to welcome foreign assistance? And Mueller says, it's problematic, at the least. And that was supposed to be like a big moment. Why? You know, everyone can have their own judgments about these things. I think, obviously, it's problematic, and you shouldn't welcome foreign assistance in an election. But just Bob Mueller, the Democrats have been using him as a crutch. He's going to do the investigation. He's going to tell them what matters in the investigation. And he's going to create the TV moment that's going to create the political drive for impeachment. And I just think that's been pathetic. They should step up themselves or shut up.
Does this take impeachment off the table? Because what I was looking at here and imagining about impeachment, Felicia, is Democrats have this idea that impeachment hearings will be useful in some way, that they will focus public attention on the president's wrongdoing more than it's already been. They will change minds. Wouldn't impeachment hearings look kind of similar to these hearings?
I think there's a real reason that Democrats are conflicted on impeachment, because it is it's a confusing and almost difficult strategic question as to whether or not hearings would do more to actually attack the president or, as you say, look like a non-issue. So I think the impeachment issue remains confusing. But I want to go back to the Russia question, because we can talk about Bob Mueller all we want, but let's not forget that the Senate Intelligence Committee on Thursday released a report about Russia's targeting of our elections in 2016. It looks like they are doing the exact same thing in 2020. They're already doing it. We are seeing no additional federal attention to this. We're seeing no additional federal funding for it. This is a problem that actually right and left ought to be concerned about. And I think the fact that, Rich, you dismiss it or try to make it a subset of Bob Mueller's performance this week is wrong.
Rich, setting aside specific legislative solutions, are you confident that election officials in the 50 states, all of which Russia made efforts to breach election systems in 2016, are you confident this issue is being handled appropriately?
Well, I think I've even heard Mark Warner saying on TV that at the agency level, the Trump administration is taking this seriously. I think some Democrats and folks on the left are now calling Mitch McConnell Moscow Mitch because he doesn't want to rush to pass one of these so-called election security bills that would do a lot to federalize our elections. And that's just not the way the system's set up to run. And it doesn't mean he welcomes foreign interference, doesn't mean he wants foreign interference. But I don't have the insight to know what's happening at every single state in the country on this. But it's something people should obviously be aware of and be trying to harden our defenses against.
As these hearings were happening, we also got closer to finalizing the budget agreement that sets federal spending levels and raises the debt limit for the next 2 years. It's a bipartisan agreement, but the deal passed the House mostly with Democratic support. There were actually enough Democratic votes for the deal that could have passed with no Republican support at all. About 2/3 of House Republicans voted no. Rich, is that vote tally a sign that Democrats got the better end of this deal?
Yeah, I think, you know, Republicans got more defense spending, which they wanted, but they're not enthusiastic about the overall level of spending. I do think, though, it's kind of the final nail in the coffin of the Tea Party. The Republicans are a big spending party now. They're not as big a spending party as the Democrats want to be, but the deficit obsession and the debt obsession is all gone now and may return pending a Democrat winning the White House and wanting to spend more than even Republicans do. But this was the final nail in a stage of Republican politics that is now over.
Felicia, to the extent that you saw objections to this on the Democratic side, they tended to come from the left, saying that it spends too much on defense, that it doesn't impose enough restrictions on the way the Trump administration spends money related to its immigration efforts. Do you think Democrats made a good deal here?
I think one really important thing happened in this budget deal, which is that we got rid of the sequester. We got rid of automatic spending cuts that were just, as we saw when we talked about this earlier this year during the shutdown, were just so problematic. And what that 2011 law did was every couple of years we had an environment of crisis that was sort of self-manufactured because we had to undo funding levels that were artificially created. And we created a kind of brinksmanship. In the meantime, Congress still had to fund the government. And so I think getting rid of automatic spending cuts was a very important part of what happened in this last deal.
One criticism I've been hearing from Democrats of this deal, it runs out in mid-2021. People are saying it sets up a situation where you could have a Democratic president and you would give the Republican Congress power soon in that president's term to pull basically what happened in 2011 with Barack Obama and threaten a debt ceiling crisis and try to force some big spending cuts related to that. You talk about getting rid of the sequester. You're getting rid of the lever that has forced Republicans to the table over and over again since 2013, 2014, which is Republicans are focused on undoing the automatic spending cuts in the military. And you've seen relatively smooth deal making in most cases, starting with Paul Ryan and Patty Murray in 2014. Do you worry about setting up that 2021 crisis?
I do worry about setting up other kinds of spending crises, but I think what we have to do, which I think we're going to talk about later in the show, is really rethink what it means to fund the federal government and to actually use public investment spending. So I wasn't there. I don't know why they couldn't get past sort of June 2021. We've seen very many short-term deals that were far less than 2 years. So I expect that this was really the best that the speaker could get. And I think that pushing it out this long actually gives us time to start talking about what the debt to GDP ratio really ought to be. I have some confidence that actually we can both get more revenue and increase our understanding of what that ceiling ought to be so we can actually really start funding government.
Felicia, what do you want to talk about?
Well, what I really wanted to talk about was this recent polling we've seen that has us looking very hard at how important independents are in the 2020 presidential race. You know, you've seen Trump's approval rating about 10% higher in must-win states like Wisconsin and Florida, and most of this is with white non-college voters. So I think it's really important to look at these independents to ask what do they actually think about the economy and why might they vote? On what basis might they vote? And there's a couple of things that Democrats should really focus on. First of all, many of these white working class voters are economically distressed, and that could actually affect their 2020 vote away from Trump. I just did a study for the voter study group with my co-authors Lee Drutman and Vanessa Williamson, and we found that not only 1 in 5 Republicans think more like a Democrat on economic policies, they want to tax the rich, they want to raise minimum wage, they say they're more likely to vote against President Trump because of that. The second thing is that when you go right to the ultimate swing voter, independents who are economically progressive, these people are 7% of the electorate, and they have already started switching their votes. They pulled the lever for congressional Democrats by 16 points more in 2018 than they voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So you have, correctly, I think, this focus on independents and white working class voters. But let's not forget that these folks are actually economically progressive.
So, Rich, it feels to me like there are hazards and opportunities for both parties in these areas that Felicia's describing. I think that these observations actually, to a significant extent, informed Donald Trump's 2016 campaign with his emphasis on the needs of workers rather than entrepreneurs, on trade and being in favor of tariffs, de-emphasizing entitlement cuts that previous Republicans had been more enthusiastic about. And then you see Democratic policies, some of which poll really well with these voters and some of which don't poll so well. And so you have different policies that Trump would like to emphasize versus the ones that Democratic candidates might be emphasizing in 2020. Do you think that Donald Trump is on strong enough ground with these kinds of voters?
Well, that's a big question. I don't know the answer to it. It'll do a lot to determine 2020, the outcome. I think what we're seeing potentially on the Republican side is a giving away of the language and the logic that had made the Republicans a small government party kind of across the board. You kind of listen to what Missouri Senator Josh Hawley is saying, and he gives these big denunciations of the free market, or says the free market's not the be-all and end-all, denounces the elite and wealthy people, and then the policy is, well, maybe we should have more tax credits or something. But there's no reason that the case he's making wouldn't support much more government activism than Republicans have ever had before, that wouldn't support tax increases on the rich in the way the Republicans haven't advocated before, I don't know when, 100 years more. Trump was might have just been a precursor to this. And we've talked a lot on the show. He kind of got the populist appeal and the populist rhetoric, but a lot of the economic policy has been traditional Republican policy. And I just wonder whether that traditional Republican policy will wash out in future years.
Felicia, when you describe these voters in the middle as economically progressive, presumably that depends on precisely which progressive economic policies you're talking to them about. And you're seeing this fight in the Democratic presidential primary right now about how far left to be on these issues and what to emphasize. So, for example, a public option health insurance plan polls extremely well. It even polls pretty well with Republicans, polls almost universal support among Democrats, very strong support among independents. But there are a number of items on the progressive policy agenda that are underwater in the polling. If you ask about Medicare for All that replaces private health insurance, there's a new Marist poll out last week that has that underwater, 41% in favor, 54% opposed among the whole public. And then things like offering health insurance to unauthorized immigrants as part of a national health insurance plan, very unpopular. Slavery reparations, very unpopular. So you have certain aspects of a progressive economic agenda that are getting a fair amount of play in this presidential primary that do not poll well, and that I assume do not poll well with these specific economically distressed working class white voters that you're talking about.
Right. Well, the two or three issues that poll extremely well with these particular economically distressed voters are higher taxes on the wealthy and higher minimum wage, which isn't surprising. And then if you look at that Marist poll, you do see that Medicare for all who want it, a kind of public option, which I actually think is a path ultimately to a much greater kind of federal support of healthcare. That polls at 70%. You see government regulation of prescription drug prices also polling at 67%. You see a Green New Deal polling at 63%. You see a wealth tax polling at about that. So these are very, very progressive policies. And if you had told me that these were in 2015 or 2016, that these were going to be the policies that 70% of Americans were going to support, I would say, maybe we have a really progressive country.
Rich, I mean, you sort of describe what Josh Hawley is talking about with his sort of, repositioning conservatism as against bigness, whether in the public or the private sector, and taking on big tech as to some extent vaporware. And you talk about a way that you could put more meat on the bones, but it sounds like that's not a way that you would want to do. What is the alternative? I mean, isn't the diagnosis right that, Ryanism was tired, did not speak to the interests and needs of voters in the middle of the electorate, didn't speak to the working class part of the Republican Party base? What is the alternative to moving the Republican Party in that direction?
Well, I think it's coming up with intelligent alternatives that don't have big economic downsides. If Republicans want to get on board a big federal minimum wage increase, I think, for instance, that would be a mistake because you're squeezing certain people then out of the lower end of the labor market, which are jobs that are really important in terms of getting training and skills and getting to the next rung of the labor market. So you don't want to endorse policies that have unintended consequences. And on entitlement reform, I think it's just going to be an economic necessity, and necessity is a matter of accounting at some point. This is a heck of a problem, though, for a party that's going to have a more populist orientation and going to have some appeal in places like Pennsylvania and the upper Midwest, presumably going forward. What is a form of that entitlement form that would be politically saleable? And I just don't have an answer to that.
I actually want to turn back to this question of key swing voters and focus on a minute subsection, but a very important one. There are 6% of Americans who say they approve of Trump's management of the economy, but they disapprove of his overall performance as president. So this is a really interesting group. And these voters say they're holding back from voting for him because of their own values. They don't think he's going to be a good role model for their kids. Their values on non-economic issues, mostly family separation, immigration and climate, and their real concerns about his character and temperament. So I think that is also a really important group to look at.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute to talk about the Green New Deal. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. We're going to do something a little unusual in this segment. Felicia has brought a guest with her, J.W. Mason, who is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. J.W. is an interesting new paper making a macroeconomic case for the Green New Deal. Felicia, before we bring in J.W., can you set the political context a little bit for us? Can you talk about what this paper represents in terms of sort of reframing the debate about the Green New Deal?
Right. Well, the Roosevelt Report is really designed to do three things. First, to show that we don't have to trade off between improving the economy and making the economy more green. You can do both. So that's a reframe. The second thing is to show that to really make the transition to a green economy, not just to move to phase out fossil fuels, but also to expand mass transit or to retrofit buildings or pay farmers to capture carbon, you simply must have a public investment-led strategy. And then the last thing that the report is designed to do is to show that we can actually pay for it. The problem now is no longer climate denial. It's actually climate austerity. And the report is designed to show that that austerity is wrong.
Well, so let's bring in J.W. Mason. J.W. is an associate professor of economics at John Jay College, in addition to being a fellow at Roosevelt. Hi, J.W.
Hi.
So your paper argues that a robust Green New Deal program might entail new expenditures of 5% of GDP, which is a lot. For context, existing federal spending is about 23, 24% of GDP. You say we could incur those expenses with little or no new taxes, and that we should think of this not as an economic cost at all, but as an investment. How does that math add up?
Well, the idea here is we're trying to connect up two conversations that really have been taking place in separate silos. There's the conversation about decarbonization and climate change, and then there's the conversation about the macroeconomy. And in the macroeconomy conversation, we know that we've been facing inflation below the Fed's target for many years. We know that we faced the problem of the zero lower bound. We've faced persistent periods of high unemployment. We've faced very low interest rates in the U.S. and around the world, and now we're looking at a new round of Fed cuts. We're looking at the ECB talking about a new extraordinary stimulus.
So that's basically, the European Central Bank.
Yes, thanks. So essentially, when we turn to macroeconomics, we're looking at a world that seems to be suffering from a persistent lack of aggregate demand, suffering from a persistent lack of sufficient spending to employ all the labor and other productive resources available to us with a lot of economic costs. Then, unfortunately, when we talk about climate, we've tended to assume that we are working with an economy at full employment that's fully using its resources. And so anything that we devote to decarbonization is going to have to be taken away from meeting some other needs. But in a world where we have the problem of the zero lower bound, where we have this problem of secular stagnation, as Larry Summers and other people have talked about, of persistent demand shortfalls, it doesn't make sense to think of it that way. That when you spend money on a public program like decarbonization, not only are you achieving what are some very urgent goals for our society, but you're also helping plug this gap. You're also helping make up the shortfall in demand that, as we've seen, conventional monetary policy is simply not able to do.
So to break that down, the usual way that people think about the economy and the way that the economy works in certain economic situations is basically that if the government goes out and spends more money and either taxes or borrows in order to do that spending, that's going to crowd out other activity in the economy. The government borrows more money, that pushes up interest rates, that makes it more expensive for businesses to do private investment. And so the government spending crowds out private spending. Your contention is because of this economic situation we're in, where there's a shortage of aggregate demand, the government can go out and borrow and spend, and that doesn't crowd out private activity. So the government could spend conceivably not just on the Green New Deal, but on anything, and it essentially would cost less than it appears to cost on the government's financial statements.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The social cost of new spending is much lower when you have a shortfall of aggregate demand. And that's really, in a way, that's what a world of low interest rates is telling us. A world of persistent low interest rates is telling us that the opportunity cost of public spending is much less than it might have been at various times in the past.
I have one more person I want to bring into this conversation, and that's Joseph Mikut, who is the director of climate policy at the Niskanen Center. Joseph is one of the people on the right who's been trying to interest conservatives and libertarians in the idea that we need some sort of aggressive climate policy. Welcome, Joseph. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So is this an argument that appeals to you, that essentially, you know, so many of the debates that we have about climate change prevention and with the assumption that there is a really large economic cost associated with them, that you need to convince people that that cost is worth incurring, that basically that frame is wrong and that we can go out and say to people, actually, this is something that it's not completely free, but a lot of it is free?
Well, I think it's I'm a little skeptical, though I appreciate the argument. I agree there's evidence there's slack in the economy. In demand. And I agree that oftentimes the costs of climate action have been overstated as a means of opposing individual policies. But I do question if it's going to be a constructive move to cast the costs of decarbonizing the economy, which we should do, as a feature as opposed to a bug of the policies we want to use.
Well, I think it really depends on your read of the situation. I think if we're in a situation where we simply can't spend enough money, and we've seen this situation, we saw this situation during the Great Recession, where conventional monetary policy in the U.S. and elsewhere was simply not able to get the economy up to full employment, and where I think today there's widespread agreement that the stimulus package adopted in the U.S. and elsewhere was not large enough, then I think we absolutely have to say that spending more money on anything is a feature, not a bug. Now, as it happens, we're fortunate to have a very urgent problem to spend the money on.
But isn't the phrase "on anything" really key in there? This macroeconomic argument that you're making, and obviously this has been a controversial topic in U.S. politics for over a decade, it would apply to any new public investment. So isn't the burden still on you to show that this is the appropriate way to spend that money? I mean, you could spend it on healthcare, on childcare, on infrastructure not particularly aimed at green benefits. Isn't the burden still to show that this is the best use of these resources, even if it is feasible to finance them through government borrowing?
Well, I think to some extent our report is aimed at people who agree that the problem of climate change is an extremely urgent social problem and that it is one of our highest priorities and are concerned about the paying for side. I don't think our goal was to convince people of the urgency of the problem. I think there's plenty of other evidence and arguments out there to convince people that. I do think there's a certain argument for decarbonization in particular because there is a certain time-limited aspect to this. It's not, unlike healthcare, education, it's not something that the government is necessarily going to be doing permanently. So if we think that this period of weak demand might be something that will last for 10 or 20 years, but not forever, there's a certain argument there. And I also think there's an argument that when you want to do this kind of macroeconomic spending, there's a lot to be said for public investment in particular. And I think that that's something that clearly is a big component of decarbonization in a way that it might not be for some of these other areas.
Rich, have Republicans to an extent opened up this line of argument for people on the left, which is to say that, you know, Republicans came into office with some priorities. They wanted to spend more money on the military. They wanted a corporate tax cut. And they decided that there was no need to pay for that, that the macroeconomic situation was such that the government could just borrow more money in order to pursue those priorities. And so far, economic performance seems to continue to be fine in that environment of increased borrowing. Why shouldn't the left pick that up and pick its own policy goals and say that's what to use the increased deficit spending for?
Yeah, I don't think Republicans have any credibility at spending at the moment. And deficit spending we've had hasn't had any obvious immediate economic harms. My fear is just by the time we all agree that we can just spend any amount of money and deficits don't matter at all, we'll spend ourselves to a level where deficits matter and economic conditions will change. And it just seems to me that this paper, with all due respect to to JW, it's more of a case for spending than spending on the Green New Deal per se. And I would think if you accept those premises, and I don't, you'd want to spend on things that make the economy more efficient and more productive. There are infrastructure projects that could do that, for instance, like basic R&D. I think we're not spending as much as we should is a no-brainer. But the Green New Deal involves not just creating new sources of energy, but scourging the sources of energy we already have that represent great national wealth and are more efficient. And I just don't buy the argument that making energy basically more expensive and forswearing sources of energy that are more efficient is good for the economy. You can make other arguments for it, that it's allegedly going to save the planet, but that it's going to be a big free lunch and a boon to the economy makes no sense to me.
Well, so JW, do you buy that premise? Because it seems to me that the way that you and some others talk about some of these investments in new technology are similar to the way that people often talk about the Apollo program, which is to say that, you know, we had this expensive program to go to the moon, and we had all sorts of ancillary learning from doing that boosted productivity in the economy and that led to other useful innovations and ultimately produced more economic growth. So I think that's sometimes the argument you hear about green technology. The claim is that this particular area, both of public spending and of regulation, that force shifts in private spending, that they'll force people to do useful R&D that will make the economy more productive in the long run. I guess the question is, how do we know that? Because usually when the government comes in and tells private businesses, no, don't do the thing you thought was most efficient, do this other thing, you should tend to expect that to reduce economic output. So why is this a case where you get positive knock-on benefits from that?
One piece is, Felicia said, we're not just talking about regulation, we're talking about public investment, and there's a big difference. I think when you're trying to build up new industries from scratch, it's true that simply raising costs as something like a carbon tax, you know, this is why we don't agree with people who say the carbon tax is the be-all and end-all policy here, because all that does do is raise costs for existing carbon-intensive forms of energy and production. And we think that's not enough. You need directed public investment into new sectors, and we think there's a lot of areas where there's increasing returns, where you start an industry, initially it's not cost competitive. Initially, it can't get going on its own. It can't be successful in the market. But with smart strategic subsidies and public investment, you get to the point where it is. And I think we're already seeing this. You know, there's a reason why most of the new installed capacity of electricity in the U.S. is wind power. It's because it's cost effective. It's because it's actually cheaper to invest today for private companies. But that didn't happen on its own. It happened because you initially had public investment and you had subsidies that got it up to that point. If you ask, why is China taking off and dominating the solar voltaic market? It's because they've had smart policies of putting public resources there, building up that sector, and getting it to the point where it's then cost competitive. It's not the case that you simply already have sort of the most efficient options you have, and if you close them off, you're just going to be doing something less efficient.
Joseph, some of the arguments that JW made there are related to a declining enthusiasm that I see for carbon taxes from some climate advocates on the left, basically saying there are concerns about carbon taxes, both politically that they will end up being unpopular, and their regressivity, and arguing that through some of these other approaches, you can achieve many of the goals you try to achieve through a carbon tax, that through public investment and research and development, you can move people away from carbon-emitting activities without making the carbon tax central to your climate plan. Does that make sense to you? Is the carbon tax as important as people have made it out to be?
Well, I have to say, I think a carbon tax is the best policy approach we can take to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And that's largely for the same reasons that were just described, right? Research and development or early deployment of wind power, for instance, changes the relative prices in the marketplace, and you shift to that kind of production. That's exactly what a carbon tax intends to do as well. I think the idea that we need to do a lot more spending, right? The programs we've done previously for clean energy are not 5% of GDP. That's Defense Department types of numbers. And I just don't know that that's necessary to rid our economic production of greenhouse gases.
JW, where did you come up with 5%?
It was really just a benchmark number. That was sort of the high end. The argument was, even if we got that high, this is still affordable. It was not an estimate of what we think the cost would be. A lot of estimates out there are lower than that. But I do think it's a lot more than where we are now. I think that there is an urgency to this, which requires a level of public investment. Maybe it's not 5% of GDP. Maybe it's 3% of GDP. It's still a lot of money. Again, that number in the report was simply arguing that even if you take sort of a high-end estimate, it's still something that we can afford.
Rich, what, if anything, do you think we should be doing about this? I mean, you have people like Joseph out there trying to get Republicans to take seriously the idea that this is not just a real problem, but a real problem that is addressable through public policy and the Republicans should care about addressing. People obviously worry about the economic effects. You also see people like the president sort of sowing doubt about the underlying science and the extent to which this is really a problem. If you have concerns about, you know, specific economic effects of specific policies, what, if anything, do you think we should be doing about climate change?
Basic research and remaining a rich and dynamic society with the ability to adapt if the worst comes. But I don't believe that we're in a climate crisis. I think a lot of the rhetoric we see on the left in the Democratic Party, where every time there's a tornado or a flood or a hurricane, it's the responsibility of global warming. None of that is supported by the research. And even, you know, the most robust AOC version of the Green New Deal, you look at the estimates using the best models out there, and it just has a minuscule effect on global temperatures 80 years from now. So I think there are a lot of people who ideologically, they like more spending, they like more regulation. And I think the climate supposed crisis is their new way to make the case for that agenda, which is a very old one.
Joseph, what do you say to that? I assume this is something that you hear a lot in your work.
I sympathize with the idea that there's the impulse to have a lot more public spending is now being put on a climate action timescale, right? That this is a sort of a convenient mechanism by which to push a different agenda, which is about changing the economic structure of the United States. I agree with JW that climate is a compelling issue for public policymakers. I would push back on Rich saying that the manifestations of global warming in individual weather events and extreme events are increasingly visible when you look at the scientific literature. And we're now in a regime where we're managing both the costs of adapting to climate change and dealing with its damages, as well as reducing emissions to prevent future damages.
JW, I want to ask about how your proposal fits into the broader economic agenda on the left, which is to say, what you have pointed out about the idea that we are below capacity, interest rates are low, they appear to remain low even when the deficit grows, that gives us room to spend. You see people on the left say that about a lot of policies. You see, I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez noting that when talking about single-payer healthcare and how that could be financed. And so, to Rich's point, there even if there is room to spend more on a deficit spending basis, that room is not infinite. Eventually, you would reach a point where you were borrowing enough that deficits would matter again. And so you can use that space once. You can use it to spend, and then once you've spent it, then an additional program that you also want to implement at the same time, you would presumably have to finance that with taxes or something else. So how does this fit into the agenda if, you know, if people take up what you say on the Green New Deal, how would you also do single payer? How would you do childcare? How would you do other things that are on the left's agenda, which I assume you also support?
Well, I think we really need to bracket single payer Medicare for all, which is really vastly more expensive than anything else we're talking about, including the Green New Deal. And clearly, I think almost everybody who talks about that is also talking about some kind of revenue that goes with it.
Except Kamala Harris.
Yes. I think it's not obvious to me that setting that one aside, that we don't have space to do actually a robust Green New Deal and a robust housing program and some type of free higher education and the rest of it, because it's just Medicare for All is just much, much bigger than the rest of those things. But I do think, and this is a starting point here, the climate change problem is the great problem facing us today. It's probably the most urgent public policy problem that we face. So I don't see a problem with prioritizing that, honestly.
I want to bring in Felicia again to close the segment. We talked about the Green New Deal like 7 months ago. You were on a special edition of the show over the holidays where we talked about visions for what's coming with the left. And I remember I asked you, what is the Green New Deal? Because at the time, it really felt like more a talking point. There's been more detail that has been rolled out over the last few months. It still feels to me like an issue where the Democratic coalition benefits in terms of being able to form cohesion by a certain amount of vagueness about exactly what the policy is going to entail. I mean, for example, JW's paper is sort of agnostic on the use of a carbon tax, doesn't endorse or reject it, does note that if you do it, it's regressive, so you need to offset it with something that's progressive. But once you start putting details in, deciding, you know, where we're going to spend the money, how we're going to finance it, does that start to fracture the coalition at all as you have to start to make prioritizing choices? And how do you deal with that?
Well, I'd actually make the other argument that the great fragility of a potential Green New Deal is not putting enough policy specifics behind it. So what you've seen since we talked about it in December or January is a number of people putting more meat on the bones of the framework that initially came out. So you see our report where we, you know, list three different buckets in which you could really do significant spending. You see Jay Inslee's work, which really focuses much more on jobs in frontline communities and also focuses on regulation of oil and gas. Vice President Joe Biden also has a climate plan. You've seen Beto O'Rourke come out with a set of policies. You saw the House Democrats come out with, something that is intended to be somewhat in parallel to the original AOC Green New Deal. So I think that it's actually important to put enough meat on the bone so people actually know what we're talking about here. And then we can have the policy debate. Things are going to be fractured, but I actually think there's great agreement on the left that this is an urgent priority. And I think folks are going to work it out, whether it's as, you know, targets for 2030 versus 2035 versus 2050. That's something that's going to be worked out, but moving is the most important thing.
I want to thank J.W. Mason from the Roosevelt Institute and Joseph Mikett from the Niskanen Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Evelyn Farkas to talk about Iran and ASAP Rocky. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
So, guess what? We know that some of you listening right now are not KCRW members. It's okay, we're not judging, but you can still donate that old car, boat, RV, motorcycle, jet ski, or whatever that's gathering dust in your garage. We'll do all the paperwork and take it away. You don't even have to know you're supporting great public radio. Do it now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. And now we're joined by Evelyn Farkas, who is a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Evelyn is here to talk about the rising tensions with Iran, but I want to ask first about another foreign power that's on President Trump's mind this week, which is Sweden. American rapper ASAP Rocky has been jailed in Sweden for several weeks now. He was arrested for assault, though he says he acted in self-defense. The arrest has led to the cancellation of much of his European tour, and various American officials and celebrities have urged the Swedes to release him. Most notably, President Trump has put extensive public and private pressure on Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven. Trump reacted angrily when Löfven told him the Swedish judiciary is independent and there's nothing he can do to influence the prosecution. Evelyn, first of all, hello and thank you for joining us.
Hello. Hi, Josh. Great to be here.
So I'm not going to ask you to comment on Swedish law and the validity of this prosecution. My question is essentially, American diplomacy with foreign powers, I assume ordinarily, has a variety of goals we're balancing. And obviously, Sweden is not the most consequential and powerful world power we interact with, but how does it affect our foreign relations when the president picks a hobby horse like this and lobbies on it in a way that surely looks quite improper to officials and members of the public abroad?
It's so disturbing, Josh, because it's so abnormal. You know, this is another example of what the president himself would call unpresidential behavior, because normally when you have a situation where a U.S. citizen is accused of committing a crime and put in jail and faced with a criminal prosecution, the United States will not intervene politically or otherwise if the country is a democracy with a strong rule of law. Maybe you would have something happening at the embassy level. Let's say the ambassador would go and make sure that everything's proceeding as you would imagine in a democracy, that the would-be defendant has access to family, etc. But Sweden is a very strong democracy with a very strong rule of law. And so there would be minimal work that the United States would have to do there. And certainly you would never have a president publicly calling for the release of someone who's been accused of a crime. Again, in a democracy where they're not wont to just willy-nilly accuse people, their own citizens or other citizens, of crimes. The way the president has approached this is the way you would approach it and the way he should approach it in dealing with Russia. Because Russia today, as we know, or maybe this is a reminder, or maybe it's first information for some listeners, but Russia's been holding a man by the name of Paul Whelan, 49-year-old guy who went to Russia, and it looks like he was snatched by the Russians under false pretenses. It looks like the intelligence community planted some information with him and said that he was a spy. And they've been holding him without a trial, with improper access to medical assistance that his family says he needs. And that case is one where the president needs to intervene, because there is no rule of law effectively in Russia. The Kremlin is holding this guy in response for our holding of Maria Butina, and that's a whole nother story, a Russian national.
Obviously, this is irregular and improper. My question is, does it matter? Are there harms to the United States because the president has picked this fight to pick?
Yes, because, of course, now he's insulted Sweden. And while Sweden is not a member of NATO, it's very closely aligned with NATO. If you just pull out your map and you look at the number one threat being Russia, you have to deal with Sweden. They provide us with good information and intelligence on what Russia's doing. We work very closely with Sweden as a partner. We obviously also have a trading relationship with Sweden. Sweden's a member of the European Union. And if we treat our friends like this, again, every other friend is going to think, when is the president of the United States going to tweet about us? And essentially, it draws down on our ability to influence our friends and others. And that's a problem for the United States of America. Yes, the president's trying to distract from probably Russian interference, because I don't know if we're going to talk about it, but two big developments are the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee released a report saying that all 50 states were targeted by the Russians. And then, of course, we had the Mueller testimony the other day. I know you want to talk about Iran, but that's probably what the president's trying to deflect attention from. But it does do diplomatic damage.
What is there to be done about Iran right now? Because you've had this escalation since the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions. Iran has been doing these provocative things. They're enriching more uranium than was allowed under the deal. They shot down a U.S. drone last month. They've been intercepting ships on their way in and out of the Persian Gulf. What kind of risks does this pose specifically to the interests of the United States? And what can we do about them at this point, having pulled out of the deal?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Iranians, like the North Koreans in another scenario, they would like the United States to come back to the negotiating table and make another deal similar to the one that we made with them before. The United States, on the other hand, has said, all the way up to President Trump, we're willing to negotiate. But when you then look at Secretary Pompeo's language, he said, we'll negotiate if Iran, and then he has a list of, I think it's something like 16 conditions. And essentially what it all adds up to is if Iran completely changes its foreign policy, which is unrealistic. And so we keep pressuring Iran through sanctions. The latest thing now is this tanker war, in quotes, if you will, in the Straits of Hormuz, where we're pressuring Iran and limiting their ability to move oil in particular through the Straits of Hormuz. So we're cutting off more of their potential revenue. And it's pushing them to the wall. And the hope in this administration may be that they negotiate on better terms. It may be that there's regime change. This is the problem that I can identify as an American trying to figure out what my government's trying to do. And it's also the problem that I think is in the back of the Europeans' minds as they are trying to navigate the situation, because they don't want war. They don't want escalation. They're not pushing for regime change. They would prefer to go back to a negotiated settlement, something along the lines of what we had before.
Rich, do you have a sense of what the strategy is inside the administration right now? Because you have these officials, including the president, who are all over the map on how they would seem to like to approach Iran. You have the president sort of openly talking about John Bolton as someone who it favors hawkish actions that he would never favor. On the other hand, you had the president allowing Rand Paul to go try to negotiate, a very dovish member of the party. Is there a theory within the administration of how they're going to get Iran in line?
Well, the consensus across all factions is squeezing Iran, and we'll continue to see more of that. I expect these certifications for so-called civilian nuclear work in Iran that Iran's cooperating with the Europeans with and that we basically allow by certifying it, I expect those not to be renewed, which would be another pressure point. That was a big benefit from the Iran nuclear deal, be one of the last benefits to go away. But what comes next is the big question. And I do think Trump imagines this as a prelude to diplomacy and negotiations. I think that's probably where we're more likely headed rather than toward more intense conflict. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what the Iranians think as well. And I think so far the administration's handled it fairly well, the various provocations in the Straits of Hormuz. We can do more to provide security to shipping, and we're heading that way. But given that Iran seems desperate to be retaliated against in some sort of major way and desperate to be bombed, presumably because it thinks it would create domestic political problems for Trump, that it would create greater tensions in the U.S. alliance with its European partners, it's probably not a good idea to give them that, and Trump hasn't yet.
Felicia, do you buy the idea of Trump as the keystone of restraint here, who has held this together?
Yeah, I don't agree with Rich's read of the situation. as I see it, I think the Trump administration's response is really incoherent, and it actually reflects a deep internal divide, because on the one hand, you see maximum pressure for regime change, you see a doubling down on sanctions, you see threats of military attacks, and on the other hand, you see, and this has been true from the beginning of the Trump administration, not just with Iran, but you see a really deep isolationism that is at the heart of putting America first. So I think it's really tough to be strategically smart in a game of chicken when you've already tipped your hand that you're going to swerve first. And I think that going back, as we've already said, to rules of law and being a nation of law, that is the best way to create more stability in the international system.
Evelyn, is it possible to put the deal back together if Trump decided, you know, that he's going to send Rand Paul or somebody else as an envoy and try to, you know, presumably Trump would say, like, this is like the USMCA. It's very different than the thing that came before it. If the president came around and wanted to get back into something that looked like the Iran deal, would that still be in the offing? Is that something Iran would
absolutely
still do?
Absolutely. Yes. I have, Josh, an op-ed in the Washington Post now almost a month ago that essentially lays this out. We just need the president to decide that he wants a deal, and the deal can include all of the elements that you had in the Obama deal at the JCPOA, but he can make it better. He can include missiles. I think the Iranians would go for that. Maybe he can get some of the Americans that the Iranians are holding released in prison in Iran, perhaps also Tice, the American that is being, Austin Tice, being held in Syria. The Iranians might be able to get him sprung. So a few other things, maybe some language on a resolution, a peaceful resolution for Syria. I believe the Iranians would come to the table and they would make a deal like that. So I think it is possible. The problem is that it seems that the administration wants a maximalist outcome. They're not going to go for this kind of compromise. And I think, because that's unrealistic, it will drag on this tit-for-tat situation with the Iranians, where the Iranians will continue to escalate to try to get us to make a deal. And the risk for that entire time will continue and possibly increase, the risk that we will have some kind of military confrontation.
If the president does what you're advocating here, goes back and gets a deal that's like the old deal but a little bit better, wouldn't that be a vindication of his whole strategy here? Wouldn't he show that indeed by pulling out of the deal and by doing this aggressive posturing that he had succeeded in improving on Obama's deal?
It could be, if what he got was good enough and or better enough, I guess. if those watching thought it was substantially better, I mean, I think if it was like MCA and it was just incrementally better, you would have some discussion about that, some debate about it. But yeah, it could be successful. The only thing is, again, the U.S. government is taking on a lot of risk with this strategy. If I were in the White House, I would want to negotiate an end to this to limit the risk to the U.S. government, to the U.S. military, to U.S. personnel, to the United States of America writ large, and the economic interests we have, because we have a whole nother bunch of issues to worry about besides Iran.
I was going to add, yes, it's true. The administration's demands right now are very maximalist. They'll have to decide what their really gettable deliverables are that they want to seek in a negotiation. But also the Iranians, I don't think, have any incentive to do anything before November 2020 in the hopes that a Democrat is elected president who will just return to the deal, no questions asked.
Well, aren't they in a lot of economic trouble? Wouldn't it be to Iran's significant advantage, Evelyn, to get out from under some of the sanctions?
Yeah, and that's why I think that President Trump can get a better deal. And frankly speaking, I've been hearing Democrats say, you know, those who are running for office, but other experts say, you know, yeah, now if we got back into office, we would also want a better deal. So let's go for the better deal, but let's not drag out the situation where, because the other cost of it, getting back to diplomacy where we started, Josh, is that we are really severely straining our relations with the European allies, and we need them, as I said, for a bunch of other more important situations, Russia, China, et cetera.
We're going to have to leave that there. I want to thank Evelyn Farkas, senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Josh.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Felicia Wong, what's your rant?
On Wednesday, the Federal Trade Commission issued a $5 billion fine against Facebook. But that fine, as big as it sounds, is insufficient. It's actually weightless. Facebook had already set aside $3 billion to pay potential fines, and its stock price actually rose after the FTC announced the fine. But more importantly, as FTC Commissioner Rohit Chopra, who cast one of the two dissenting votes on the deal, said, the settlement imposes no meaningful changes to the company's structure or financial incentives, which led to these violations. The fine leaves the company's business model intact. Facebook is the tip of the iceberg. Regulators have to go after the concentration of power that causes harms and not just slap fines on top while leaving those structures intact.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Senator Josh Hawley stands accused of resorting to anti-Semitic tropes because he repeatedly used the word, quote, cosmopolitan to describe borderless elites at a conservative conference on nationalism last week. It's true that the word has historical baggage going back to Joseph Stalin in the 1940s, who used it when he was embarking on anti-Semitic purges in the Soviet Union, but it's a word that's used widely in the academic literature because it's so useful. It's also a word that cosmopolitans use to describe themselves. So in short, Josh Hawley is innocent of the charge, and it's a perfectly good word in our contemporary context.
For my rant, Mark Kleiman passed away this Sunday at the age of 68. Kleiman was a public policy professor at NYU and one of America's leading experts on drug and criminal justice policy. He had a brilliant mind in these areas. He described how you could make parole and probation systems more effective and less draconian at the same time. He designed drug legalization regimes that would discourage increased drug use and dependence, and he advocated an approach to drunk driving that focused on the control of problem drinkers, a policy that appears to save lives both on and off the road. His research and his work with lawmakers improved lives and will continue to do so after his death, as states reform their criminal justice systems and move toward marijuana legalization. Mark was always generous with his time when I wrote about these issues. He made me and so many other people smarter about them, and he will be missed. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Felicia Wong, J.W. Mason, Joseph Mikut, and Evelyn Farkas. Left, Right, and Center was produced by Rebecca Mooney. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.